top of the page. It's an easy way to shop, and you can help Catholic Radio at the same time. The website can be found at AveMariaRadio.net.
This is full-time Catholic Radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the Internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us.
I have a very special guest today on Church and Culture. Father Michael Collins is on the phone with us from Dublin. Father Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Teal. Lovely to be with you.
Now, you have a book that's just been published in the United States by DK, which is a company of the Penguin Random House Group. And it's a book entitled Pope Francis, A Photographic Portrait of the People's Pope. And Father Michael, I'll just say right off the bat that this is a great book. It's the best photographic essay I've ever seen on any Holy Father, any Pope, and I've read quite a few. I found it touching. I found it instructive, enjoyable. It's 256 pages, but I went right through it in one sitting. Congratulations, you and your photographer, who is Rodolfo Felici, from six generations of Italian photographers for the Pope, for the Vatican. It's a stunning achievement. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. We had the idea about a year ago because, as you say, the Felici family have been in business since, I guess, more or less photography was invented in the middle of the 19th century. So they've been working with the popes in particular from about the late 1890s, Leo the 13th.
Right.
And they've photographed, I think it's nine popes successively, right up to the present Holy Father Francis. So I met Rodolfo one time, I think it was maybe last July, June or July, and he said, would you be interested in doing a book? Because I'd written, for the same publisher, DK, I'd written a book on the Vatican, which was, again was a kind of a pictorial essay book. And he'd figured in it, because we did a number of people, a day in the life of everybody from Pope Benedict at that time to a Swiss guard, to a choir boy, to a gardener, to a sister of Mother Teresa's order, etc. And he was the photographer that we'd followed around, and he'd come with us as well. So I said, well, look, let me go and talk to them in London. I was over a few weeks later. I gave them the idea, and they said, yeah, it sounds very interesting, because one thing about Pope Francis is he seems a really popular and unpredictable person. And remember, DK, I think a lot of listeners will probably be familiar with their books, which are travel books, and then very...
But they're beautifully presented. I mean,
yeah,
your book
they're
is
wonderful
gorgeous.
Publisher.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it is wonderful. Their stuff is really great, and they do a lot of guidebooks. So everywhere you go, cities throughout the world, you're always going to see people wandering along with this
right.
guidebook. But what we wanted to do was produce a book which would be easy for people to get to dip into, to give them an idea of who this extraordinary first Latin American Pope is. I say the first because he's Francis, and he can only be called the first if somebody else takes
his name
later on.
He's Latin slash Italian, as you explain in your own
biographical
essay.
Well, yeah, that's true, of course. Yeah, that's true. We set at the very beginning of the book, we put about maybe six pages just to give people an idea of who he was, because it's strange, a lot of people don't really know many of the details.
Right.
They know he's from Argentina. He was archbishop somewhere, and then he became pope. That's
right.
A lot of people just say.
But they don't know that his grandparents were fleeing fascism in Italy.
Yeah, correct. In the 1920s, they decided that the political situation in Italy was deteriorating. They didn't want to be there anymore. And along with a lot of people, they chose the Americas, both Latin and North America. They went to the South because of the language and the climate. They decided to make a new life in the New World. So the Pope's father was one of six children with his parents who sailed over to Argentina. They set up in Buenos Aires in 1929. Then he, the young Mario, who eventually became the Pope's father, he married a few years later to an Argentinian stroke Italian girl. And they had a family, five children, and the eldest of them is Jorge, who obviously went on to become the Pope. So
right.
His life story is extraordinary. It's very, very interesting in the sense
that he was a very handsome young man.
Yeah, he's got very good looks. I think the thing that most people like about him, or, in fact, I love getting comments from readers what they like or dislike about the book, and I think everybody's united in the fact that they say he's a wonderful face. He's such an expressive face.
Yes, very expressive.
And I saw a few days ago he went down to the opticians to get new glasses.
He snuck out of the Vatican.
Yeah, he said, "I'm not going to make the poor optician come to me. Let me go to the shop and I'll have a better choice."
I love it.
Yeah. And then it was funny, apparently he said to the optician, those frames are fine, I don't need new frames, I think I need to correct the lenses. And the optician said, but, there's no problem, I can give you new...
Let's touch up those frames there, Holy Father.
Exactly, I think that was the idea. And then he said, no, they're fine, look, one pair is okay with me. And then he whispered to the opticians into his ear, he said, listen, don't do me a deal, I want to pay the right price.
Sweetheart.
So he's so down to earth, he's really nice. And then some people say to me, he shouldn't live in a gilded cage anyway, he should be out in the, doing ordinary things, go do his grocery shopping, he should be traveling on the bus, he should be doing all these things, and he's the very first one who'd agree with you.
Well, there is a security issue. I mean, there really is.
Well, that's a huge problem, absolutely, a huge problem. But, so far he's managed to go fine, although it is very funny, I saw a photograph in a newspaper, actually, I write for, called the Catholic Times in England.
Yeah,
and
we know
they
that.
You know that? Okay, well,
of course.
They have a wonderful photograph.
We're not that parochial, Father.
Well,
we know that Catholicism exists in the UK, sort of.
Yeah. Well, it was nearly stamped out by our friend Henry VIII, but they kept the branch there. But there's a wonderful photograph in the newspaper about 4 weeks ago, which I just laughed at. And it's the Pope, he'd gone out somewhere for the day to some meeting, to something official. And when he was coming back, because he had no escort, he was just in his ordinary Ford Focus, and get this, that's Ford Focus, a USA brand car. He doesn't use the Merc like the old days.
Right.
He's just going around in an American car. And funny enough, it's the same car and hatchback that I have, so I feel
really
spiritual affinity, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I had it before he decided
to. I wonder when Ford will start cashing in on that.
Well, I can't believe, I cannot believe Ford has not started taking ads out of the Pope. But the funny thing is, he got stuck in the traffic jam trying to go through an arch, and there was a big articulated lorry, and it was trying to get through it, it got stuck. And the Pope's car was stuck behind him, and, he couldn't back out, he couldn't go sideways, he couldn't go forward. And, I don't know what eventually they obviously, unbuttoned
him. Maybe they just, like they do in Naples, they just picked him, the whole car up and moved him around.
Well, that could be it, actually, turn him around, face the other direction.
They do
it, I think that's the lovely, that's the lovely thing about it. But then again, the other side of him is, I think, a lot of people don't realize this is a very shrewd cookie. He really knows what he's doing. He's not just doing this let me put it this way. I think he's got a very clear political antenna, and he knows that if he's seen doing things, it's going to change people's perception. Not of him, because he's not so worried. He's 78, going on 79 in December. He's not overly worried about his own persona. But I think he is very concerned about just changing the way that we would see the popes. And I think he wants the popes, with all due respect to them, to be a little bit more accessible, to be more involved and engaged in the real world. Because the fact is, once you're made pope, you really lose all your freedom.
Yes.
And you become, as you said earlier, you become a property of the security people.
Well, let's cut right to the chase on that issue. I'm talking with Father Michael Collins, who's talking to us from Dublin, and just published a really wonderful book that I encourage everyone to own, especially on the eve of the Pope coming to the United States. It's entitled Pope Francis, A Photographic Portrait of the People's Pope. And you address in the preface the issue that many American Catholics are concerned about. And I'm going to read what you said, and then I'll ask you to comment. Because, frankly, I think this book is the antidote to what a lot of people are feeling about Pope Francis here in the United States. And here's what you say. You say, for many popes, Francis's unpredictability is part of his charm, but for some, it is a source of exasperation. And then I'll skip down to where you say, this variability is sometimes courted trouble. His expressions not always translate well into other languages and cultures. And frankly, that's happened so many times during his papacy that, you know, the most well-intentioned and faithful people started raising eyebrows. But I think your book provides such a larger scope, a larger panorama of who he is and what kind of pope he is. I found myself just kind of forgetting about those issues as I read through it.
Yeah, I think yes, that's very true. I think, for example, a few weeks ago he was talking about children and bringing up kids, and he said, you know, it's no harm to give your kid a slap every so often. Of course, that went all around the internet, over
the
headlines.
I'm from Texas, so I'd say, you know, that's fine with me, Father. You know,
okay.
You know, I know, but there is a lot of political correctness on that. Now, that's interesting on that particular issue. He sort of stepped on the feet of the people who sort of idolize him. They think he's one of them, you know, a man of the left with a capital L.
Sure, and actually that's another interesting point, because a lot of people want to capitalize on him, and especially now I think in America with the presidential nominations coming up shortly, both sides of the parties are going to be anxious to get him, because he's got a very considerable Catholic vote. There's 75 to 78 million Catholics in North America, and then a large proportion of those will be Hispanic. So, you know, anybody who wants to be a political candidate for the presidency will need to take cognizance of that, at least.
You may not know that I ran Catholic outreach for both of President Bush's campaigns.
So I
know the Catholic vote thing pretty good, and Catholics on a given national election are about 40-45% of the national vote. But more importantly, they're very numerous in so-called swing states like Ohio and Florida that have a lot of electoral votes, which is what actually elects our presidents. And so what happens is that, and I led this for two elections, so I know it inside and out, is we concentrate all our efforts to reach Catholic voters in these states, and it becomes, you know, pretty much a trench warfare. And in this upcoming election, the Democrats view themselves as having a great advantage, Catholic advantage, because of this pope. Do you think that's fair?
Well, now, I have to say you'd know a lot more about that situation than I would. The only thing I could maybe comment is that I think a lot of people would say Pope Francis is progressive. And a lot of people would say he's conservative. And I think both sides are right, because in some areas he is very progressive. I think in his social doctrine, he certainly has pushed the boat out.
Yes.
And, well, that is almost going to be a bad taste pun when you look at the boat people coming from the north of Africa across the Mediterranean. And he said in absolute exasperation, you know, what you're doing is you're turning the Mediterranean into a cemetery, into a graveyard.
Yes.
And these poor people are coming over. They have nothing. So be merciful to them.
Yes.
And at the moment, there's an enormous debate going on all over Europe.
Where they're not letting him ride the trains in Hungary. They're not letting him get on trains.
No. And it's, you know, it's something, it's been stepping up so rapidly. Now, I've been following this for about 6 years because I lived in Italy for a long time. And I've been following the fact that so many people have been coming over from North Africa. And their first stop really is Italy. And the reason for that is because it's a long peninsula with the largest coastline in all of Europe. So therefore, it's easiest for them to escape the police and then to snuck into some little promontory or some little port and maybe begin a new life. But over the last number of months, and in fact it's now years, that just has exploded. And interestingly, the very first trip the Pope Francis made outside Rome was not to any big city even if he wanted to go to Italy, he could have gone to Milan, Florence, Venice, Turin, Naples.
He went to Albania.
Well, that was, you're right, his trip abroad, but his first trip, if you like, into the homeland of Italy was to this tiny little island called Lampedusa.
Right.
And a few weeks ago, I met the former parish priest of Lampedusa who became a cardinal, and that's kind of curious. You know, Pope Francis hasn't made an American cardinal yet in his two consistories, the ceremonies that he creates
right.
and nominates new cardinals. Not one American has been nominated. In fact, the amount of American cardinals with influence has actually decreased significantly under Francis, because
yes.
Cardinal Burke, for example, has gone off to the Order of Malta.
He's become something of a public critic. Of the Pope.
He doesn't pull any punches, and I've great respect for him. I've met him a couple of times. An extremely courteous and extremely nice man, but he cannot hide his, I'd almost say, distaste of the way that the papacy has been
disappointment. Yes.
Yeah, his disappointment, I think it is. But he's a most sincere man, and he's also an extremely intelligent and observant critic. And therefore, you kind of say to yourself, if I was Pope, I'd have kept Cardinal Burke right in the central office. In fact, I'd have given him an office next door to mine, because he's an extremely competent man.
But on the other hand, he got the cardinal from Sydney, who is considered...
A Cardinal Pell, George Pell.
Considered very conservative.
Yeah, he's very conservative, and they put him in charge of a very unusual office called the Prefecture for the Economy, because Pell is actually a theologian. He's no great, he's no great ability, I guess, in finances. But, since he went into that job, he's done a very sterling job, and he's managed to turn the Vatican finances, which were really a cause for scandal, he's turned them around,
right.
and everything's kosher once
more.
But
he's caught a lot of heat for it.
And he's taken and of course there's a lot of people in the Vatican who are employees. And remember, sometimes people think about the Vatican that the Vatican is just populated by nuns and priests and brothers. Well, that's not the case. The majority of the people who work there are lay people who are working, let's say, in security, in information technology, in the museums, the fire brigade, the there's all sorts of people working there, information officers, etc. And many of them will be kind of critical of Pope Francis for this reason. He didn't give them the traditional pay rise when he was elected. He hasn't proposed any pay rises. And he's quite critical of the work of some of them, saying that, they really have to pull up their socks. So, back at home, not everybody's smiling. And that's
He's willing to criticize all sides.
And in fact, some people are getting a bit annoyed with him at this stage because going back to our friend, when he said about it's a good idea, well, not a good idea, but he said it's okay sometimes to slap a kid. There was public outrage. And my mother, who I suppose I'm biased like all kids, I think my mother is, a font of wisdom, an extraordinary font of wisdom. And she said, well, he's got something to say there, because if you a child at 4 years of age is running out in front of a bus, you can't sit them down and start talking philosophy about philosophy.
No, you
can't. You've got to sit, give them a slap, and then say, now, every time you go out in front of the bus, you're going to get a slap.
Well,
until you
learn that's dangerous. And there are slaps, and there are slaps.
Sure, sure. I mean, and in fact, he had to withdraw that, and he said, what I really meant was, keep the kid's dignity, keep the child safe, and that's it. But anyway, that's what you were saying. He sometimes jumps out of the fire into the big cesspool, and that could be dangerous. But at the same time, he is a person who's he's happy to chastise all sides, and he sometimes comes over a little bit like a nagging parent. And that turns off a lot of people, in fact, that they say, he's always nagging, he's always giving out. And then they sit down and they think about him, and then they say, like we often think about nagging parents, problem is they're right. Because, he's only saying it from common sense, mostly.
Right. Now, let's get back to your book. And I want to, again, tell our listeners, this book, which was published in August, just last month, entitled Pope Francis, A Photographic Portrait of the People's Pope, is wonderful. And I strongly recommend, especially those who have been annoyed or irritated or disappointed in things they think the Pope has meant by what he has said and so forth, or by the so-called climate change encyclical, which was quite controversial here. look at this book. And if you know me, you know that I share some of your concerns. I just went through this book, and I had a big old grin on my face. And let me give the author here, Father Michael, an example of some of the things that I loved in the book. For example, you have on Good Friday, you have a picture of his head, his face, as it's bent in prayer, very close to the floor on a pillow, and you get a very intimate look at his face as he's praying. In another case, you have a picture of him with a dove actually being released from his hand, which is beautiful. And then you've got a picture of some basketball player showing him how to twirl a basketball on the top of a pencil. That's hilarious. Yeah. And then you have this great quote next to that picture. And the Pope says, "Only if a sport remains a game will it do the body and spirit good. Always seek to do better with team spirit and fairness." And I'm telling you, I'm a sportsman. I'm a big golfer. And he's so right. You can't make sport into work. You can't.
Correct.
The joy on his face in so many pictures, and the joy on the faces of the people who see, for example, on page 232, when the Pope was visiting Brazil, you have a picture of nuns on a balcony who are jumping and clapping. Wonderful photo.
Yeah. The nice thing about the book is the way we put it together, and I have to say, I'm only, 2 to 3% of the whole work. There was a whole team in the publisher's office of about 12 people. And one of the lovely things I got such a kick out of was that many of them, in fact, I think virtually all of them, were at least Protestant or, let's say, non-Catholic. They weren't.
Well, it was England.
Well, it was England, okay.
Yeah, right.
And a lot of these people were from, well, I think some of them were Church of England, let's say.
Yeah.
But there was a girl, I think she may have been, oh, gosh, I don't know what religion she was. But anyway, she was a wonderful girl, and she also was blessed with a photographic memory, which is an amazing thing if you're a picture researcher.
Right.
So when we had our meetings in London, I'd say, there's a wonderful picture I saw of the Pope having his dinner in a canteen with some workers, and he was, oh, yeah, that was on the 27th of July, 2014. That was in the, and she'd mentioned the name of the place. Bingo, she was it. And then she'd say, I'll just pull that up, and she'd go to her computer, and within 5 seconds, the picture was there. Incredible. But I have to tell you, Neil, they loved working on the book, so much so that when I went over, I was in London maybe 4 times with the book. I spent about 4 days, just going through photographs, and Rudolfo came over from the Vatican, and he went through photographs, and we tried to sift it together. And they would say, well, maybe this photograph works well. But they actually, all of them, stayed late every evening because they enjoyed it so much. Now, I don't know many employees who stay late at their work.
Well, but you created the narrative along with Rodolfo, your photographer, Rodolfo Felici. And just so our listeners know, one thing that makes this book so effective is the way it's laid out. You begin with a wonderful preface, but then you go into his life, focus on his career, bad word choice, as a priest and a bishop. Then his election at the conclave, and then you describe a papal year.
Yes, so that's a good way of putting it, because what we wanted to do, we reckon that most of the readers would like to have maybe 5-10 photographs of him as a young boy and as a young man, etc. And the majority, really, they want to know the Francis of today, because they're not overly interested in who he was before then. In fact, one of his critics, Leonardo Boff, said, forget Jorge Bergoglio, because, he had quite a checkered past in the dirty war in Argentina. A lot of people said he could have done a lot more to oppose the government. He could have done a lot more to save some of the priests who were in danger.
We've heard that before, Pope Pius XII,
Sure. And a lot of people would say Jorge Bergoglio has a lot to answer for. And he himself, actually, even as Pope Francis, he keeps on saying, he says this repeatedly, he said, I ask God for mercy for my sins, not for sins I may have committed, but for sins I did commit. And he's very clear. He's very hard on himself as well, actually. And that's, I like that in a person who will be honest enough to say I've made mistakes. But what we didn't want to do was give a kind of a lost view of this. So what we did was we tried to take the photographs. We started off with the day that Pope Benedict announced his abdication. That's the very first photograph of the book that begins, as you say, it's the narrative.
And by the way, you pay great tribute to Pope Francis's predecessor.
Oh, well, I have terrific respect for him. I absolutely think he was the most wonderful pope, and I think history, when it rewrites itself and balances the books again, I think people will see that those 8 years intervening between Pope John Paul II, who died in 2005, and then the abdication of Benedict in 2013, I think Benedict did an enormous amount of good. It was he who actually tackled the whole child pedophilia problem.
Yes, very aggressively.
Oh, very aggressively. I mean, I remember coming across one time, he said that on Fridays he did his penance, his Stations of the Cross, simply by reading the dossiers of the priests who'd been sent to his office in order to be punished and to be stripped of their office. And, you know, that was the whole thing. And he said it was dreadful to read these stories. And, you know, he comes from a very old-fashioned German world where everything, in a sense, ran like clockwork.
Right.
And that's why I get so annoyed when I hear people talking about God's Rottweiler. Benedict, and I met him so many times as Cardinal Ratzinger, he was an absolute old-fashioned gentleman.
Yes, he was a charming man of the old
charming
European tradition.
Totally. Okay, the world has gone on ahead of him, maybe, and left him behind. But
well, that's sad.
Such a nice guy. Well, exactly. We're the losers, I think.
Yes, we are.
But I have terrific respect for him, and you can't understand Francis without having...
Well, Pope Francis has... I mean, after all, South America, and especially a place like Argentina, is steeped in European culture, as well as Hispanic and indigenous, so forth. He himself demonstrates that kind of same dignity and manners that Pope Benedict had.
Yeah, that's absolutely
true.
But
he's more loose about it. He's not as Germanic about it.
No, absolutely not. No, but at the same time, then, he has brought different priorities. Pope Benedict was very keen on restoring a sense of sacred in the liturgy, because if you think of it, he was elected in 2005. That's, let me think, it's close on 50 years at the end of Vatican II. And he often said, every time there's a big ecumenical council of the Church, there's reverberations that go on for 50 or 100 years until things settle down again. So he had enough experience as a historian and a theologian. He was able to reassure people, look, what we're going through is the pulling apart of the tectonic plates of the past. And until they all settle and stop moving, we're going to have a lot of controversy.
That's very well put.
Stirring up.
I'm talking to Father Michael Collins, who has written an absolutely wonderful book, along with his photographer Roberto Felici, on Pope Francis, and we're going to talk more about that and all the wonderful things that Father Collins has seen with his own eyes in the Vatican after this short break.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is brought to you in part by our day sponsor, to celebrate the 17th wedding anniversary of Bob and Valerie Kirschgessner, parents of Andrew and Thomas, and parishioners at St. Leo the Great in Amherst, New York. Congratulations, Bob and Valerie. You can be a day sponsor, too. Call toll-free 1-877-288-1077 and say, I want to be a day sponsor.
We are here hiding in the back of the annual Catholic Media Awards. With me is Dr. Ray Guarendi, the odds-on favorite to capture his 10th most humble host award. Dr. Ray, how do you think you'll do this year?
Well, in all humility, John, I think I got a pretty good shot at it. I think the last 4 years I've been unanimously nominated, and I think that I think it speaks for itself regarding my humility.
Well, let's listen in to hear this year's winner.
And this year's Catholic Media Humility Award goes to Al Cresta.
What is this? Cresta must have bribed the judges. It's not a fraction of my humility. Besides, he showed up to collect the award, so that automatically disqualifies him. Bet I'm going to appeal this ruling.
Well, Dr. Ray is going to have to train a lot harder to take his humility into the superior range. And you can hear him training Monday through Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern on The Doctor Is In.
My attorney's going to hear about this.
If you want to use your gifts and talent to support women and the unborn, contact the Arbor Women Pregnancy Center to volunteer.
Arbor Women needs pro-life people to support, nurture, and empower women facing unexpected pregnancies. Arbor Women are in need of nurses and sonographers with a current Michigan license, as well as pregnancy and post-abortion counselors. Call the volunteer coordinator at 734-994-8863. That's 734-994-8863 to learn how you can help.
I'm back with Father Michael Collins, who's talking with us from Dublin about his book recently published on Pope Francis. It's a picture book, but it's not just a picture book. It has a wonderful narrative about Pope Francis's life, a year in the life of Pope Francis, and chapters on each of his journeys abroad, which are very, very interesting. But, Father, before we go into that, I just want, you're coming to the United States and you're going to be here for the papal visit. Tell us about that.
That's right. Actually, I'm going to arrive on Tuesday, the 8th of September. And originally, I was to do a short book tour going to New York, Washington, and Philadelphia. And then there was so much interest in the book, and, you know, I always say this, this is all a tribute to the subject of the book, which is Pope Francis. Mm-hmm. The publicists at DK, they've lengthened it and lengthened it and lengthened it, so now it's a 21-day tour. Yeah, and I'm crisscrossing. I'm going to New York, then up to Washington, then to Philadelphia, down to Boston, back to New York, back to Philadelphia, all in 21 days. And they have so many interviews and book signings mm-hmm. and events. And then I think we're going to finish off with the Pope's Mass. And I'm hoping to be able to help with the media on the Pope's Mass on the 27th in Philadelphia. I'm going to be back for 2.5 days, I think the 25th to the 27th. Well, that's 2 days.
Well, you'll find Philadelphia crowd, Archbishop Chaput and all his staff will welcome you with open arms.
I joined Twitter recently, which I think is ghastly because it's all about self-promotion. It's funny, and what I love about
what is your Twitter feed so
people,
our listeners can sign up?
Well, it's called Fr Mike Collins. So I suppose I guess
Father Mike Collins.
Michael Collins.
Easy.
Yeah, Father Mike Collins. But there's so many young people contacting me, which I'm absolutely
great.
Thrilled about. There's a crowd of young people who have made a T-shirt, silly T-shirt. I think it's a Pope T-shirt mm-hmm. or something like that. And they've been in contact, and they've asked me to join them. And they said they're really enjoying the Pope's visit because it gives them, as young Catholics, the opportunity of getting together out in public and being proud of who they are, which is wonderful as well. So I'm hoping to meet up with them.
So I suggest that our listeners. I suggest our listeners. Well, first of all, you have a website where I'm sure a lot of this information is found. That's FatherMichaelCollins.com. Now your Twitter with Fr Mike Collins, which is great. And those of you that are sort of alive to book signings and so forth, you know, keep an eye out. You might find that Father Mike Collins is coming to your town to talk about his book, Pope Francis, A Photographic Portrait of the People's Pope. Father, I have to mention a few other of these pictures in here that just
sure.
wonderful. I've been to Israel and the Holy Land of Palestine 5 or 6 times. I know the situation there, how bad it is. But these pictures of Pope Francis's visit there and having Shimon Peres on one side and Prime Minister, President Abbas on the other, was a very powerful depiction. With of course,
I'm
Patriarch
so
Bartholomew I right there.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that because that was a wonderful visit. And apparently, Pope Francis, when he was, well, obviously before he became Pope, when he was Jorge Bergoglio in Buenos Aires, he made friends with a Jewish rabbi called Abraham Shorka. And he was, the two of them, in fact, hosted, if I'm not mistaken, a TV channel in the diocese. And they put on a weekly show. And he got very friendly with the rabbi. And, in fact, they've written a couple of books together. And when he was going to Israel and Palestine, he called his friend, the rabbi in Argentina. He said, you know, I've got to go to Israel, Palestine.
Right.
A very delicate situation. what advice have you got for me? What can you tell me to do or not to do? And he said, well, he said, you know, why don't I come over to Rome and see you?
Oh, wonderful.
So the Pope said, well, would you do that? I mean, it's a long way, because he hates traveling himself. He hates airplanes. I mean, this, for example, this is going to be his first trip to America. He's never been to North America yet. So he said, would you come to the Vatican? And he said, yes. And then he said, you know who I'll ask as well? And he asked another friend of his, whose name escapes me. He was a Muslim cleric. And he said, he was from Argentina as well, and he knew him. He said, why doesn't he come as well? And you all come and you stay with me. You're my guest for the week, as long as you want to stay. But the thing that really caught my attention was the place the Pope lives in is like a very, well, it's, they call it a motel, and that's probably the closest. It's a kind of, it was actually, it was paid for by an American philanthropist, which is very generous. But it's a very, it's almost like a Holiday Inn, but really, really kind of simple. And when the Jewish guests were going to come, the Pope said to the kitchen people, he said, you know, we need to do a lot of cleaning around here, and we've got to rearrange the refrigerators and the ovens, etc., because Jewish people have their way of doing it, and it's called kosher food. And he explained this to the people working in the kitchen. And then he said, you know, could you do this? And they weren't able to do it, so they got in a Jewish expert at food and dietary requirements, etc. And he came in and turned the kitchen in the Pope's house into a kosher kitchen so that the Jewish people would feel completely at home. I mean, there's not many people who go to that trouble, I can tell you.
No, and actually I aired a little bit. That particular picture was taken in the Vatican after the trip to Israel when the Pope invited Perez and Abbas and the Patriarch there for, I guess, what would amount to kind of peace talks.
Well, exactly, because he spent his few days in the Holy Land, and he annoyed very much the Israeli authorities, because when he was leaving Bethlehem on his way, I think, down to Jerusalem, he was due to go to the what we call the Wailing Wall. Mm-hmm. And before he did that, he got out of his car and he prayed at a wall which had been put up around Bethlehem. And he,
I know that wall well.
There. Okay, and then
I've seen that wall built over the years. And
well,
Bethlehem
okay.
is essentially now entirely circled, either by walls, by Jewish settlements, and it's a prison camp, frankly. You can't get in or out without going through heavy security and passes you have to apply for weeks in advance. In fact, the only Catholic university in the Holy Land, which is Bethlehem University, run by the Christian Brothers, you have students there who are from Bethlehem that have never visited the Holy Sepulchre Church in their lifetimes.
Wow. Amazing.
It's that bad.
Amazing.
So,
amazing.
And it's very very easy for a pope, and this was true with John Paul II and Pope Benedict, to antagonize Israelis because they're so sensitive on the matter of the relationship going back to World War II and the Holocaust.
Correct, yeah, that's true. That's true. And in fact, they didn't mean to antagonize them. They just did it, no. You know, by accident, if you like. But Francis didn't mind. He said he's going to stop, and he made a memorable phrase, I think, when he was getting back into the car. He said, you know, what we need, he actually quoted John Paul II. He said, you know, so true. What we need is bridges, not walls.
Yes, and that's,
you know,
exactly.
So simple, and that's exactly what we needed. But I think those photographs were great, because then he said to the two politicians, the two presidents, you know, come to the Vatican and let's talk. You'll be in a neutral area. You'll be away from your own countries, and maybe we can make a breakthrough. It didn't happen, but the fact is that it didn't have to happen. They had their talks, and they spoke, and they, you know, maybe got to know each other a little bit more. But unfortunately, as we well know, very often behind politicians are huge blocks of voters, and they've got to be really careful to keep those.
You know, a few other photographs in our book that I loved. You know, on page 2005, you had a picture of the Pope trying on an alpine hat. And then on page 204, you have him trying on a red clown's nose.
That's marvelous.
But he's able to do this without making himself look silly. I mean, he's able to do this without looking like he has condescended. I mean, he's just having fun and enjoying the people that he meets.
Sure. And actually, you know, the majority of these photographs were by Rudolfo Felici and his father Giovanni. As I say, they're in business over 150 years, and at least the family is. And one of the things Rudolfo said to me, he said, you know, when the Pope is at Mass or at any of the liturgies, he's very solemn and recollected. In fact, he looks a little bit cranky because his face is made that way. In fact, I recall one time, just in parenthesis, one of his auxiliary bishops said when he was taking photographs after a confirmation ceremony, they'd gone down to McDonald's with the children to bring them, you know, to have a little party. And he said to Cardinal Bergoglio, he said, you know, are you going to stand in all the photographs like that and ruin them for the kids? Because he's kind of a glum face. But he said when he's in the church and he's praying, he looks a bit glum. But he said as soon as he takes off his vestments and he's out with people, he's back to action. And he loves the interacting. He loves the crowds. But again, I often think, you know, he's a shrewd cookie. He knows exactly what he's doing. For example, one time there was a priest who was from Argentina, and he happened to see him during the general audience in St. Peter's Square, and the Pope spotted him and he said, are you on your own? And he said, yes, I am. He said, jump on the jeep with me. And he went round, and the Pope said to him, you'll be all over the world in a few minutes, because he knew that that picture would be circling the world. Same with some kids he takes around for a ride on the mobile. Then he got down one time, and there's a man suffering with a very bad disfigurement on his face. And the Pope just took his face in his two hands, and he bent over and kissed him. And then not alone did he kiss him, but then he leaned over, and he hugged him, and he rocked him. Well, you know, if you can't produce a tear for that, you don't have a heart. That's my
No, and your book is filled with wonderful moments like that. And as I said, I think there are moments that need to be seen, not just by Catholics and non-Catholics of goodwill, but especially by those Catholics who have been irritated, is the word I'll use, by some of the off-the-cuff comments, as you talked about, and perhaps even the emphasis on climate change. Now, you have also some very, I would call, more serious pictures, and the ones I've mentioned, you have wonderful pictures of ordination of priests, with them lying face down, facing the altar. You have wonderful, joyful pictures of a wedding ceremony, I guess, or I should say a blessing of 20 couples who got married. And this wonderful pictures of what the manger scene is like at St. Peter's during Christmas. Those are the pictures I've never seen before.
No, they are lovely. And I have to say, one of the decisions we made very quickly was that we wanted to take real-life photographs, or the photographs that we used, because the Felicis have an enormous archive. We only had, as you say, 256 pages to fill, which is not much. There's around, I think there's about 1,700 photographs in the book. But we didn't take any still photographs. We didn't have anybody pose. And, in fact, I enjoy reading on Amazon people's comments about the book, because, you know, very kindly, when they buy the book, they then give a voting and give a comment. And the majority of people all say, you know, they like the fact that these are not posed photographs, and they do bring you behind the scenes.
And they're vivid,
you know,
they're alive.
And a few photographs, okay, they might be slightly out of focus, but when we were sitting around the table in London deciding what would go in and what would go out, we said, no, this is a nice one. Okay, it's not perfect. And the kids are, you know, maybe they're not dressed the way they should be, or some of the adults, or the poses aren't great. But they're fantastic photographs. And I love the way the Pope takes off his little white skull cap and puts it on somebody's head as a joke. And, you know, one of the nice things also I liked also is that he is very at ease with women. And this is an issue, to be honest, I think many, many listeners will probably identify with this, that many popes had maybe not so much ease in these past years with women. This man is very much at ease in his own skin, and I think it's partly to do with his age, because one of the benefits of getting older is we lose a lot of our inhibitions and we become more relaxed with ourselves. And, you know, he's very, very happy to be with people, regardless who they are, where they come from, what level in society they are, whether they're rich, the poor, it doesn't make any difference to him. As far as he's concerned, they're just humans like him. And that's why the idea of, we spoke earlier of him going to visit the optician last week. It's a human thing. You know, he said, why, if you need glasses, you go to the optician. You don't make the optician come to see you.
Ha.
So it's, you know, he's just doing ordinary things. And I love the fact that he's got flat feet. And I love his sister. She doesn't give interviews anymore because I think they phoned her and said, listen, stop talking to the press because, you know, you're talking, what you're saying is terrible. But she had a funny story one time. She said that when they went to Rome, when he became cardinal, they were walking along the street and she said, oh, did you get a car? And he said, well, yeah, the car has been used. And she said, oh, somebody told, one of the priests told me all the new cardinals get a car for the times they're in Rome. And he said, well, you know, and he didn't want to tell a lie. He said, well, you know, I reckoned we didn't really need a car. And then she didn't say anything. I think she was a bit disappointed. She could have gone around in a really, you know, classy car. And she said, ha, huh, there was Jorge just walking around with the big flat feet.
That's wonderful. I'm sure he didn't mind at all.
No, he didn't care. I don't think he did at all. No, and then another lovely, I wrote a book for Liturgical Press, it's more a textbook. It's a small, short biography of 144 pages on Bergoglio. And that is very funny because the editor called me. I was in Rome for the election, and the editor called me the night before the conclave began, and he said, Michael, would you write a book on the new pope? And I said, hold on. They haven't gone in even to elect him yet, so you've got to wait until we know who he is. I said, yeah, but I think people will be interested in a biography. I'd written other biographies. So he said, would you do that? And I said, well, yeah, but it depends. And I was leaning out a window on a mobile phone trying to get reception, and I nearly got killed. And I said, yeah, but I think we better find out if he's an interesting pope or not. Little did I know what we were going to get. And so I had great joy in doing this for Liturgical Press.
Did you have to get any kind of a permission for the or after?
No, not at all. In fact, I sent him a copy of the book, and he sent a very nice letter back saying, you know, that he enjoyed flicking through it. But, of course, he didn't tell the truth because he didn't use the word flicking through it, but he said something like leafing through it. And because he doesn't read English very well, his English is, you know, quite basic. But it went into Spanish afterwards, and I sent him a copy after that. But and actually, you know, with this present book, I gave him a copy of the present book, and he wrote a very nice letter, and he said, it's true to say that picture speaks a thousand words. And I was wondering, because I hadn't expected that he actually would read it, but I was wondering, he read it on the evening of the 23rd of July, I was wondering, what must it be like to be Pope of the world, sitting there in your armchair, leafing through a book that an Irish priest on the other side of the world has written
right.
about you, and you're seeing pictures of yourself from angles you never knew about before.
Right.
And you know, I thought it was so great.
Now, I'm curious, the situation of the Catholic Church in Ireland is tense, to say the least.
It is.
How has this book been received there?
Very well, yeah, it's great.
It must have helped the situation somewhat.
Oh, sure. Well, it's not so much. Listen, the book, honestly, is only, you know, it's a small book. It's the person. Pope Francis has really made an enormous impact.
I disagree with you. It's a big book. It's about a, you know, a big man, a big story, and it has great big spirit in the book. So
yeah,
I wouldn't go
yeah.
talking about your book being small, Father.
Okay, well, it's a big book with a big product.
It's got a big heart in it. It's got a big heart
yeah,
in it.
Yeah, sure. And I think, you know, we're very happy to have him because, you know, his latest intervention. I was actually at the conference on climate change and human trafficking a few weeks ago in the Vatican, and it was very, very interesting with the mayor of New York, Washington,
right.
New Orleans, Seattle, San Jose, Boston. You know, they were all there with the mayors of Paris,
right.
Stockholm, Berlin, you name it, and they were there. And the Pope came in, and he did a lot of people talking about climate change, and he said, he didn't quite say it in the words I'm going to use, but he more or less said, you know, climate change and human trafficking go hand in hand, in his view. And he said the reason for this is because if the climate is changing, and keep in mind, the climate is changing because the Earth is changing and the sun is changing, so we've nothing to do with this. We've no control over it.
He said that. He said that.
About the climate changing.
Yeah, he said
No, he's linked the two. He's linked the
two.
Oh,
I see. Yeah.
But there are things. I mean, we all agree. Look, the core of the Earth is changing, etc., and it's heating, and it's cooling, it's heating, etc. The sun is having its sunspots and radiation bursts, etc. So we've no control over a huge amount of global warming. But there is certainly an input. And one of the questions is, do we need to burn all the fossil fuel now, or could we wait for a couple of hundred years till we discover a new way of extracting energy from that source? But his point is that if the climate changes for whatever reason, whether it's natural causes or it's human-induced causes, whatever, if it goes up another 2 degrees by the end of this century, the city of Bangladesh in India is going to go underwater, like parts of Manhattan, and people are going to have to move somewhere. So there's 100 million people living in that area. They're going to have to go somewhere. People are going to start building walls to stop them getting in, like, into boundaries and barriers. And this is going to cause huge social unrest. So he's just saying, you know, wake up, smell the coffee, there's problems on the horizon, and we've got to come to some way of resolving them. So, you know, he's not a warrior. He's not an eco-warrior. He's not.
That's very interesting. He's not an eco-warrior.
No, he's not. No. He's quite sensible. I think he's got, you know, he realizes that humanity has to be careful with his resources. We have to husband our resources, not just for ourselves, but for maybe 500 years away. But you see, we're too busy thinking about where the next buck is going to come from. And he's just taking the longer view and saying, you know, we have to be responsible. We've got to use our resources wisely, not just for today.
I know that our listeners are going to be very, very grateful to you for reporting that. I'd like to have you back after all the traveling in the U.S. and the dust has settled.
Sure,
I'd like to have
you
back on Church and Culture to talk more about that and other things that you've been able to see personally. And we have only a few minutes left. Father, tell us, what do you hope this book will do to those who sit down with it and read it and look through it? What is your hoped-for outcome of this book?
Well, you know, I think you put it very nicely at the beginning of our conversation. You said you had a smile on your face, and I'd love if people had a smile on their face when they finished reading the book. I really would. I really would, because they'd see the person, they'd maybe understand the message a little bit more, and they'd say, you know, the Earth is lucky to have this guy. You know, and the lovely thing about him is he keeps on criticizing himself and saying he makes mistakes, he makes bad judgments. In fact, he always says, my first gut reaction is always wrong. And I'm the same as well.
Wow.
And he trusts the wrong people. I do the same thing as well. I always end up trusting the wrong people, and I overlook the people who are faithful. And, you know, I've bad judgments, so I love the fact I'm in good company.
Yeah, well, you know, people are tricky. Same things happen
people
to me
tricky.
Many, many times. And I'm constantly told I'm too trusting, but I can't help it. You know, that's just the way I am.
Yeah, but I'd love if we had maybe people who read that book, especially people who are maybe disaffected by the church, who've been hurt by people mm-hmm. who had a role in the church, maybe a role of responsibility, who hurt them, who abused them, who caused them pain, who caused them to lose their trust, their hope, their faith. Yeah, their faith. And this happened so many, many times, and I'd love if they could feel that there is somebody at the center. He had a lovely expression I came across when he was speaking to the cardinals the day before the election, or a few days before the election. He said, the church should be like this, like the moon. It should simply reflect the light of the sun. You know, but
you put that in your preface. I think that's
I like that. I love that phrase. It made a lot of sense. He said, when the church just reflects Jesus, everything's okay. When the church starts building itself up and gets pompous and, you know, he didn't say it like this, but I think behind his mind he's thinking, you know, ritualistic and full of ceremony and all of this stuff. So I guess like pompous.
In fact, I want to tell our listeners one more time that you've been listening to Father Michael Collins from Dublin, who has published a book entitled Pope Francis, A Photographic Portrait of the People's Pope, and he collaborated with one of the sixth generation of papal photographers, Rodolfo Felici from the famous Felici family. And Father Michael, thank you so much for being a guest today on Church and Culture.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm really looking forward to catching up with you when I come
yes,
to Washington.
Yes, I look forward to meeting you and having you back on the program. And I, once again, all you out there, take a look at this book. You're going to love it. And also, we're going to take a short break and be back with another very interesting guest.
Father John Ricardo was one of the spiritual warfare teachers at St. Gerald Parish last spring.
I think people are here for lots of different reasons tonight. We're like mailmen. We're in the business of delivering the gospel. And because you're a mailman or a mail person, whatever you are, and you're delivering the mail, every once in a while dogs come after you to try to prohibit you from delivering the mail. So if you're a smart mailman, you carry a stick so that when the dogs come, you can beat them off and you can deliver the mail. That's what we do. But we're also trying to help people, first of all, maybe tell you better get a stick if you don't have one, and to help maybe find you a stronger one as well.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Last April, the youth group at St. Gerald Parish in Farmington, Michigan, sponsored an evening of teaching on spiritual warfare with their pastor, Father Ron Brown, and Father John Ricardo. We'll hear it on our next program. Listen to Putting on the Mind of Christ Sunday afternoons at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Hi, this is Teresa Tomio from Catholic Connection with a reminder that Heart to Heart Catholic Apostolate meets this Thursday, September 10th at Domino's Farms right here in Ann Arbor. And guess what? I'll be speaking at this event along with my husband, Deacon Dom, to talk about intimate graces, how practicing the works of mercy brings out the best in marriage. It's based on our brand new book and released this September. That's this Thursday starting at 7:30 in Lobby H of Domino's Farms. For more information, hearttoheartcwa.com. Again, that's hearttoheartcwa.com.
Weekdays at noon, it's More to Life.
Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak. Each weekday on More to Life, we'll explore the life you were meant to live through the theology of the body.
Tune in for great advice, guests, and the information you need to take your marriage, family, and personal life to the next level.
Weekdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
This is Father Frank Lavone of Priests for Life. At abortion clinics across the country, the bodies of unborn children are literally thrown in the trash each day. At some of these places, pro-life people have gone into the dumpsters to retrieve those bodies and carry out the corporal work of mercy of burying the dead. Over 40 gravesites now hold the bodies of these children. And on the second Saturday of September, we invite you to join us in honoring them. Simultaneous memorial services will be held at these gravesites on the National Day of Remembrance, sponsored by Priests for Life, Pro-Life Action League, and Citizens for a Pro-Life Society. Please visit abortionmemorials.com to learn more about this special day and to find the nearest memorial service. Read about the history of these burial sites and learn what you can do to help end abortion. This is Father Frank Lavone on Ave Maria Radio.
John Erickson always wanted to be a great author, and he ended up writing a great series of books about a Texas cow dog. Hear how his story started and how you can help your kids start telling stories of their own. That's next on Homeschool Heartbeat.
John, the last time we visited, we talked about the impact your mother's storytelling has had on you as an author, but you didn't set out to start to write folksy stories about a dog. Would you tell our listeners how you ended up finding the stories that you now write?
You know, when I started writing, I was a college student, and the only model I knew about was kind of an intellectual approach, a literary approach, and I tried that for